It's Banned Books Week, time to assess which books make Americans most uncomfortable. Violence and curse words are two of the top three reasons books get banned in the U.S. The third reason, surprise, is sex, which is how a sex education book for children became one of the most banned books in America. Did you hear that, parents? This story is about a sex education book for kids 10 and older, and it will last about 3.5 minutes. You know what to do. Here's NPR's Rebecca Hersher.
In the world of book banning, sex is a loose term. Last year, the top banned book in America was the kids' story, Captain Underpants. It was banned for potty language and toilet humor. The sex ed book It's Perfectly Normal, which is meant for kids 10 and over, is a little more explicit than that. Barbara Jones is the director of the Office for Intellectual Freedom at the American Library Association.
What we see in this book is illustrations of the sex act, women and men naked. And you see people with lumps here and lumps there. And whereas some people chuckle, I think for some people it's alarming.
Full color illustrations of lumpy, naked people have helped make It's Perfectly Normal one of the most banned books in America. Since its initial publication in 1994, the book has been challenged or banned every year. Michael Emberly illustrated the book. The author is Roby Harris.
I was warned by several people not to do this book, that it would ruin my career. But I really didn't care. To me, it wasn't controversial. It's what every child has a right to know.
The book includes sections on puberty, pregnancy, and sexual orientation, all fact-checked by experts like pediatricians and biologists. Internet safety and sexting are new topics in this edition.
Here are some things you need to think about when you go on the internet. There can be a lot of inappropriate, weird, confusing, uncomfortable, creepy, scary, or even dangerous websites that you can end up on when looking for information.
This edition also has new explanations of gender and sexual abuse. Past editions have included other cultural changes, for example, birth control laws, AIDS prevention, and info for gay youth. A lot of parents don't want their kids learning about that kind of sensitive information without supervision. Carrie Fritz of Culver City, California, has two kids in elementary school. I caught up with him as he was waiting to pick them up from school and asked him his impressions of the book. What do you think?
Well, I was shocked. I didn't read the cover.
He flips through the pages and stops at a full-color illustration of various birth control methods and how to use them.
See, if they saw this without me, I'd probably feel a little frustrated. Look at it. I mean, that would take time for me to have to explain.
What are you seeing there that's making you say that?
Well, right here, at least what it's doing here, is just talking about sexual activity, which I don't think a 10-year-old needs to worry about.
Over the years, many parents who share this sentiment have asked for the book to be put in a restricted section of the library. It's not a ban. Parents just don't want their kids to come across it accidentally. Author Roby Harris doesn't think that's a good solution.
No child's going to go up to a librarian and say, you know, I'm going through puberty, I'm having these changes, I seem to have some pubic hairs, and maybe you could recommend something to me. So if a book is in a special section of a library, maybe the kids who need it the most are not going to get it.
The latest edition of It's Perfectly Normal hit shelves earlier this month. So far, it has not been challenged. Rebecca Hersher, NPR News.
The writer Jeff Hobbs had a roommate at Yale University.
He considered him his best friend, a student from New Jersey with a poetic name, Robert Peace.
He was funny and very bright, smiled a lot, which is not to say he was totally agreeable, because he had opinions. And, you know, if he disagreed with you or thought you were acting like an idiot, he would certainly let you know it. But he would also tell you if he was proud of you, which is very rare for a man, and particularly a young man.
Robert Peace was a great student with tremendous potential. He also sold marijuana in college. After graduation, he returned to his hometown, eventually to teach high school.
9 years after that graduation, in 2011, Jeff Hobbs got the news. His former roommate had been murdered, shot while dealing drugs just outside Newark, New Jersey. The shooting drove Hobbs to make sense, if he could, of what happened to his friend. His interviews with the roommate's family turned into a book, The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. and you hear the emotion in Hobbs' voice as he describes what he found. Peace was African-American, born to a working single mom in a tough neighborhood during the crack epidemic of the 80s.
He didn't talk much about that. You know, over time, I began to understand that he did not come from abject poverty. His family owned the home he grew up in, but there were very little means, and I knew that his father was in prison, Rob said, for manslaughter. In fact, it was for the murder of two women when Rob was 7 years old. He was imprisoned for life.
It's clear you spent a lot of time with Robert Peace's mother, Jackie. What was she like?
You know, I could go on and on about Jackie. I think she's the only perfect person in this story. She was a working mother. She worked very hard, and then she came home and spent as much time with her son as possible, and she took him to the library, took him to the park. When he was about three in daycare, the lady there told Jackie they were calling him the professor, and she thought they were making fun of her, or worse, they were making fun of her son, before she realized that they were calling him that earnestly in reference to his intelligence and curiosity.
Hmm. Now, how did it affect Robert Peace, still well under the age of 10, when his father was arrested for a double murder and eventually, after a long delay, put on trial and convicted?
You know, the father-son bond is big stuff, of course, and particularly here, Rob really revered his father, who was sort of the mayor of the neighborhood, as I gathered, had a kind word to say about everyone. They would leave the house and go eat full meals at seven different friends' houses over the course of the day. And he was very active in Rob's academic life, drilled him with good penmanship, the importance of memory, and continued to do so from prison, you know, using the prison phones once or twice a week.
I wonder if I could get you to read from page 57 a passage that describes the way that Robert Peace behaved after his father went away.
Sure. Despite the attachment he felt to his father, Rob came to scorn abandonment above all things, and as he turned 11 and fifth grade began, he aggressively assumed the role of husband to his mother. She would find dinner plates covered with foil in the fridge when she got home late, leftovers of whatever Rob had cooked for himself that night. Sometimes she would wake up around midnight after a few hours' sleep, and he would be in the rocking chair beside her bed reading. He began working odd jobs on weekends for people he knew through his father, raking leaves, shoveling snow, painting, for a few dollars per gig. Always he divided these earnings and left half on the counter for his mother. If he made $6.50 over a weekend of helping move furniture, and his employer gave him an extra 15 cents for a candy bar on the way home, Rob factored the tip into his wages, rounded up 1 cent, and left $3.33 for Jackie.
Mm. That rounded up cent.
Yeah.
Did this experience somehow make him a better person?
It's really hard to say. Life is so messy. I think it made him a leader. And also, I think that experience really built his incredible capacity for friendship, particularly with friends in his school and around his neighborhood, many of whom shared this plight of fatherlessness.
Did that difficult experience also contain the seeds of his eventual downfall?
Perhaps in that, you know, it really soldered his attachment to his neighborhood. You know, he went to Yale and then he came back. But that's a bigger question. You know, why does the country seem to demand that if you come from a certain socioeconomic level, in order to succeed, you have to leave your home behind? You know, he came back from Yale and he taught high school other young men like himself, many of them from broken homes, and he was really great at that.
And that side of him was inspiring. But then there was the other side that was involved with drug gangs.
Yeah, and this he was never involved with gangs. He placed himself in that that particular orbit where violence is not uncommon. Also, you know, he liked the feeling of being the man, I think, be his own boss, I suppose.
Did you ask yourself, after you learned that he had been killed as part of a drug deal, whether anything could have changed his course?
I did. And, you know, there is the question in this book, in this story, about whether you can save people. I'm sure that Rob asked himself that same question. He worked most of his life to try to free his father from prison, you know, try to pull his friends sort of forward in life along with him. And I think he probably decided near the end that you can't really save people.
What made you want to figure out the life of this man you had known who had been killed in this way?
You know, I was brushing my teeth next to my wife when I learned he had died violently and pointlessly, you know, a mile from where he'd grown up. And the funeral, 400 people, you know, very painful, also beautiful, people from all over the world in downtown Newark. But outside that church, it seemed like a lot of people were almost eagerly condemning him as this cliche of potential squandered. You know, it was just, we were there, it was sort of a reunion aspect to it with mutual friends, and, you know, we just knew he wasn't. Rob Peace was not a cliche. We write about what conflicts us, whatever medium, and nothing's ever conflicted me more than this loss.
Jeff Hobbs is the author of The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much, Steve.
It's NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. Novelist Sarah Waters has been shortlisted 3 times for the Man Booker Prize, and she's been named one of the best young British novelists by the journal Granta. Book critic Maureen Carrigan says that Waters should expect more prize nominations, and possibly a win this time, for her latest novel, The Paying Guests. Here's Maureen's review.
Sarah Waters' new novel, The Paying Guests, is a knockout, which isn't a word any of her characters would use. Waters' novel opens in 1922. The Edwardian age with its high collars and long skirts is dead. The jazz age is waiting to be born. At least that's the case in the suburban backwater of London, where Waters' main character, a 26-year-old spinster named Frances Ray, lives with her mother. The Ray women have decidedly come down in the world. Frances's 2 brothers were killed in World War I, and her recently deceased papa made some bad investments. Raised to be a middle-class gentlewoman, Frances now cooks up inferior cuts of beef and empties bedpans and rubs her knuckles raw, scrubbing the hallway floor. If Downton Abbey needed an extra slavey to work in the kitchen alongside Mrs. Patmore, Frances is more than qualified. But The Paying Guests is no simple period piece. As alert as Waters is to historical detail, she's also a superb storyteller with a gift for capturing the layered nuances of character and mood. Any reader familiar with Waters' earlier novels, like Tipping the Velvet, will know that she's especially drawn to the subject of lesbian relationships. What's so immediately compelling about our protagonist, Frances Ray, is that, in a way that doesn't seem at all anachronistic, she's comfortable in her own queer skin. It's most of the rest of the world, and tragically, some of the people in her own house, who have serious problems with Frances and her so-called unnatural sexuality. Waters structures The Paying Guests like a modern updating of the standard 19th century 3-volume novel. The entire story is spellbinding, but I particularly favored part one with its oppressive pre-thunderstorm air of anticipation. When the novel opens, Frances and her mother are awaiting the arrival of a necessary evil. Lodgers, whose rent money will help the Rays hold on to their large, dark house in South London. Those lodgers, or paying guests, are a married couple, Lillian and Leonard Barber, whose refined elocution class accents mark them as less genteel by birth than the Rays. In delicious detail, Waters has Francis register the change in atmosphere in the house as the invading barbers stake out their territory. While Francis was out in the kitchen assembling a cold Sunday supper, the couple came down and tapped at the door. The water closet was an outside one, and they had to pass through the kitchen to get to it. They came grimacing with apology. When Mr. Barber headed back upstairs, she heard him pause in the hall. Wondering what could be delaying him, she ventured a look along the passage and saw him gazing at the pictures on the walls like a man in a gallery. Leaning in for a better look at a steel engraving of Ripon Cathedral, he put his fingers to his pocket and brought out a matchstick, with which he began idly picking his teeth. Slowly, other kinds of trespasses into private territory take place here. I don't want to reveal much more of the plot, because one of the great pleasures of Waters' ambitious story lies in its slow unfolding, which readers should be allowed to relish for themselves. And speaking of things to relish, as evocative as Waters is in describing more intense moments, like, say, the giddiness of fresh sexual attraction, or the violent anger of ex-servicemen panhandling on a London street, she also excels at capturing the mundane. Day after day, the hours slowly pass in the raised shadowy house where three women, Frances, her mother, and Lillian Barber, are entombed. Money is too tight for entertainments. Paying jobs for ladies are still frowned upon, and only volunteer work at the church bazaar beckons. The Ray's house itself is a presence here, full of unrelenting daily demands of cleaning, waxing, and endless dusting. Frances thinks to herself that the house must produce dust as flesh oozes sweat. When Frances admits passion, the ultimate intruder, into that dull house, chaos erupts. The Paying Guests is one of those big novels you hate to see end, especially since you sense the end might be a very nasty one indeed.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the new book, So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. She reviewed The Paying Guests by Sarah Waters. If you want to catch up on any Fresh Air broadcasts and listen on your own schedule, you can download podcasts on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Molly C.V. Nesper. John Sheehan directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross.
Now we want to take a minute to visit with an old friend. His name is David Rector. He was for many years a producer on this program. David left NPR in 2008 and moved to California to pursue his dream of being on the air. But that didn't happen. He suffered an aortic dissection, a tear in a major blood vessel, that left him unable to speak or walk. Now his fiancée, Roz Alexander Kasparek, is helping give him a voice again. NPR's Petra Mayer caught up with Roz and David in San Diego.
This is a story about love. It's a story about bad things happening to good people, about memory and perseverance and comic books. But most of all, it's a story about a voice.
I'm David Rector, and we're going to start off things nice and easy with Nat King Cole and Unforgettable.
This is a practice session David recorded after he left NPR. He wanted to get his radio announcer chops back. David was here for decades, going all the way back to the days of magnetic tape and razor blades. He was known as a quiet guy, with an encyclopedic knowledge of movies, pop culture, and especially comic books.
I'm also a comics fan. That was one of the reasons David and I bonded right away.
That's Bob Molesky, who was David's boss for many years at Weekend Edition Sunday.
I tended to be a Marvel Comics person. He was a DC Comics guy, so occasionally we'd get into rather detailed arguments about the merits of various superheroes. He knew everything. He really did.
So naturally, David timed his arrival in California to coincide with San Diego Comic-Con, one of the biggest comics conventions in the country. Roz Alexander Kasparek says they had a blast.
We saw the Incredible Hulk. You know, we went to all the panels. He knew all the people. I don't know any of these people.
But they didn't make it back the next year. 8 months later, he got sick.
We went one day from basically being on a treadmill while I was in dance class to not being able to move or speak.
The man who wanted to make a living with his voice suddenly had no voice, in more ways than one. He could only use his thumb. He was given a court-appointed conservator. He no longer had the right to vote. Miserable, he stopped responding to his therapists. Roz fought an acrimonious legal battle to get him out of a series of nursing homes. And through it all, she kept notes, and she wrote to anyone who would help. One person who did help was their comics industry friend, Batten Lash, creator of a long-running strip called Supernatural Law.
One day last year, she just said, "Ben, I have this idea. David and I want to do a comic book." And it was like the light bulb going over her head because, you know, David loves comics. It's almost like therapy. Why not? Let's do it.
Lash helped Roz find an artist, a mutual friend named Trevor Nielsen. He walked her through the steps of creating a comic based on David's experiences. Roz herself says she knew it had to be a superhero comic. And that's the origin story, because every superhero needs an origin story of the character Recall. He's
part specter and part very underground human who imparts memory, seeds memory in others that's karmic.
Recall is almost like an astral projection. While his body lies stricken in a hospital bed, his spirit roams around, dispensing karmic justice by projecting memories into your mind. Do good, and you get a dose of good memories. Do bad, and you get the idea. And his side is Given, who's based on Roz. And she's called that because her love for Recall is a given. Roz says David approves all the story and art choices, and he relishes his editorial role.
The one thing that brought him back was the comic. He would wake up, he would do his little finger things, he would make himself known, he would make his voice heard with regard to the comic that would bear his story.
David Rector can't speak right now, but his voice is there, on paper, in the curves of pen and ink, and the careful lettering of a superhero comic book. Petra Mayer, NPR News.
You can see pages of Recall and Given on our website, npr.org/books.
In many families of Afghanistan, the birth of a girl is mourned. Boys are considered blessings. Girls are considered burdens. They're forced to live a strict life of limited options. They cannot leave the house alone. They are not educated for a future. And some young girls, maybe more than we know, find a way to fight that for a few years. In 2010, Jenny Nordberg wrote the first stories about girls who were called Bacha Posh, girls dressed up like a boy, to live as a boy as long as she can. The stories appeared to much interest and acclaim in the New York Times. She has now expanded her reporting into a book, The Underground Girls of Kabul, In Search of a Hidden Resistance in Afghanistan. Jenny Nordberg, who's reported for the New York Times and many other publications from around the world, joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
The book opens, you pay a visit to a woman named Azita, who is a real walking emblem of success and progress in Afghanistan. She's a member of parliament. She goes around the world, gives speeches as that emblem of progress, but her twin daughters reveal a family secret to you.
Yes, they do. This was the very first time I was invited to her house, and I came to interview her about being a parliamentarian in Afghanistan, as there are very few, and I thought that would be interesting. And I was with the two little twin girls, and they spoke a little bit of English, like a limited English, and we had a conversation that was mostly about, what color do you like? What do you want to be when you grow up? And all of a sudden, one of them said, you know, our brother is really a girl. And I looked at her and I was like, yeah, yeah. And then the other said, somewhat annoyed that I didn't take her seriously, she said, no, no, it's our sister. And at that point, I hadn't met the youngest in the family. She had four children altogether, and I knew them as three girls and a youngest boy.
How did you begin to appreciate how many families are doing this?
Every single Afghan I have spoken to, except for those who have been abroad for a very long time and are essentially expatriates, they will know of someone. They will have a neighbor, someone in their extended family, a great-grandmother, a colleague. There will usually be one in a school. In more conservative areas, there might be more. But every Afghan will know about this, and every Afghan has a story to tell.
Forgive the naivety, but how do you disguise a girl as a boy?
Oh, it's simple. You know, it's a child. So who can really tell the difference? When I first met Miran, who's Asita's daughter, she walked into the room. She's a six-year-old child. And whereas her sisters are very girly and giggly and, you know, have all those typical sort of feminine traits, this is a boy. She walks in with a short haircut, a denim shirt, hips forward, much of an attitude, points a toy gun at me. It's a whole different character. I mean, it's important to, I think, understand that in extreme segregation, where men and boys are given almost all the rights, it's very important for that system to be upheld, that boys look like boys and girls look like girls. So in a sense, that makes it easier to pass over to the other side.
So what happens when an Afghan girl living as a boy reaches puberty? Tell us, for example, the story of Zahara.
In most cases, this is when Afghan girls are supposed to become girls again, to take on the very traditional path of Afghan women, which is that you are married off to a husband of your parents' choice, and you will become a mother, ideally have sons of your own. So it's very important for these girls not to go through puberty as boys. Zahra is someone who's pushed it farther than that. She was 15 when I first met her, and she's a tomboy. She said to me, I see how women are treated here. Why would I want to be one of them? So she goes to great lengths to disguise herself as a boy, and she has constant daily arguments with her parents who beg of her, can you become more feminine? Can you grow out your hair? And she refuses. She will walk in a hunched-over way in an exaggerated male fashion and very much take on the attitude of a young man. This is how she's grown up, and this is what feels natural to her. So there are a few who actually are able to resist, but most of the time, you don't go against your parents.
You say several times in this book that you liken the attitude of a lot of Afghans to the Bachaposh as don't ask, don't tell. As long as they don't ask about it and nobody puts it in their face directly, they're fine living with it.
That's true, and that's how I came to see it. It's very much a human rights issue, and that's why I think the don't ask, don't tell works well for this situation. It's something that I would say most every Afghan is aware of. And the concept of a childhood and gender and, you know, children's rights don't exist in the same way that they do in our world. This is also a very close society, and it's a country at war, and you don't get involved in other people's business. They will, however, when we're talking about teenagers, and that's why there are much fewer of those, because it becomes risky, not to say dangerous, to try and pass as the other gender when you become of age as a woman.
Overwhelmingly, those of us who are listening to this broadcast live in a part of the world in which women have been secretaries of state and CEOs and generals and surgeons and head of the IMF. But you think we could still stand to learn from the experience of the Bachaposh?
Oh, I think it's a story about oppression, and I think that's a universal story. This is something that women and girls have done throughout our own history. There were women who joined the Civil War here as men because women were not allowed to get an education, to become doctors. It's a story of passing and how to buck the system in an impossible society. And the Bachaposh really shows this. I mean, how creative is this? Something that women have been doing for generations. Okay, you know, you're going to make it this difficult to be a girl or a woman. Well, let's try this. Let's try and just make someone into a boy.
Jenny Nordberg, her new book, The Underground Girls of Kabul, In Search of a Hidden Resistance in Afghanistan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.